Anyone familiar with the persistent use which Joyce makes of the labyrinth figure as the archetype of human cognition? So the labyrinth for Joyce means the drama of cognition. Anyone who knows that will have noticed the same figure, this S, as it appears in the dramatic action of a Thomistic article. In other words, Thomas Aquinas wrote something about a particular theme, an objection, a question, an explanation. The symbol, it had the same symbol as the labyrinth representing the archetype of human cognition. So McLuhan's going to link the drama of cognition with the argument laid out in a Thomas Aquinas article, they call it. So it says, there is first the descent into the particular matter of the objections. So I guess Thomas Aquinas would lay out what people objected to in Catholic or Christianity. So there is first the descent into the particular matter of the objections. You get involved with the argument. These are juxtaposed abruptly, consisting... No, these are juxtaposed, all the different objections, abruptly, constituting a discontinuous or cubist perspective. By abrupt juxtaposition of diverse views of the same problem, that which is in question is seen from several sides. So that's what I do in the Android meme chart. Present the four quadrants, four different ways of looking at the situation, the labyrinth. So you're back, Bert? Do you want to say
yes,
something?
Yes, my Skype was crazy. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Good. Okay.
You have nothing to add to say at this point?
No, I found the article online, so I'm following.
Oh, okay, good. Maybe you could post it. People could look at it.
Okay.
It's amazing. Everything's online. These are juxtaposed. So the objections are juxtaposed. And it's like the juxtaposition of my Android meme chart. By abrupt a juxtaposition of diverse views of the same problem, that which is in question is seen from several sides. A total intellectual history is provided in a single view. That's what I attempt to do. And in the very instant of being presented with a false lead or path, the mind is alerted to seek another course through the maze. So you have LaRouche ends up being a problem, you jump to Thompson. Or to McLuhan or to Croker. The mind, baffled by variety of choice, it is suddenly arrested by the sed contra. S-E-D contra must be a Latin term for, I'm muting.
Opposite.
For the opposite, sed contra? Okay.
Yes, it's like against something, contra.
Right. Baffled by variety of choice, it is suddenly arrested by the opposite and given its true bearings in the conclusion. Then follows the retracing of the labyrinth in the what's called respondeo dicendum, D-I-C-E-N-D-U-M. That's in quotes. Does that mean anything to you, Roxy? To respond?
Like an oral response.
Oral?
Yeah, dicendo is to speak and...
Oh, okay. Then follows the retracing of the labyrinth in the respondeo dicendum. Emerging into intellectual clarity at the end of this process, it looks back on the blind alleys proffered by each of the original objections. So, from the fifth quadrant, the Dobbs quadrant, looking back at the problems, blind alleys of McLuhan, Thompson, Croker, and LaRouche. But the sixth position, which I have Carol looking at the whole chart, she's looking at the blind alleys of male-dominated thought, just that the men were better at left hemisphere than the women. So that's a broader categories of blind alleys than the details I present from the fifth level. Whereas the total shape of each article, with its trinal, that means three, right, trinal divisions into objections, okay, whereas the total shape of each article with its three divisions into objections, respondeo, and answers to objections, all that is an S labyrinth. This figure is really traced and retraced by the mind many times in the course of a single article. So Roxy, in her videos, is doing a metanoia every video of the same issues with slightly different content. So she's retracing
every time.
Yes, because
he says it's a juxtaposition. What was the word?
Juxtaposition. Juxtaposition, yeah.
Yeah, it's this overlaying of things that connect with each other. And you see how it connects with something in the past and then with you.
Right.
With what you're doing with Joyce and McLuhan.
Right. Hmm. It seems to be a tradition. Once you know how to do this, you fall into a tradition that's been done by many people before with more limited resources than we have today. So you retrace.
Yes, and it's really like the snakes and ladders. You go in the past, and then you take the snake, you go again back in the past, and then you take the ladder and you go up again. And it's like,
yeah. And I know I do that. I've always retraced. So most people, when they go to bed, don't they think about the day's events before they go to sleep? People agree that's what people do? Common thing?
Yeah. Yes, but this is it's really looking the rear view mirror to overlay. I don't say it's to complete.
This phrase "rearview mirror," it doesn't mean someone hypnotized by the past, the way McLuhan uses it sometimes. The rearview mirror, all art is rearview mirror. So bringing in concept after a perceptual experience, then you conceptualize it, and that becomes the rearview mirror. Use the past, your past concepts, to get a frame around the experience. So rearview mirroring is the art process. Or the retracing. So when McLuhan says, people live in a rearview mirror, they do it unconsciously. The artist does it consciously. So I know in my mind, I'm always reviewing what's happened. Now, you'll notice that in my conversational technique. We'll be talking, and then I'll say, how did we get onto this angle? We have to go back and find what triggered that thought. To make us start talking about a different topic. Do many people do that? They don't in gossip. They don't go back and check about how they wander. They like just wandering around in their gossip. I insist on putting order to the gossip, moving it towards, as Roxy would say, a blinding new perception of the very process that you engaged in while you were chatting and waiting to get your ice cream.
Yes, it's like some people are just repeating, quoting McLuhan.
Yeah.
But you're always having this new insight. It's not a repetition.
Right.
I replay it.
I re-go back, rewind it, and come up in a different place.
Yes.
I retrace it. So I'm repeating the process, but not to make the same point. I'm looking for... knowing that every time you retrace it, you'll come to a different conclusion or a different insight.
Yes, it's the Zappa technique of changing the recording and remixing.
Yeah, every night the song comes out differently. That documentary
mix the bass of a song with something from other song.
Yeah,
and make something
other recordings.
New.
And that documentary you found is really good. It's one of the best ones. Just the people, the way they talk about Frank, they appreciate him, and they point out the depth. And especially Ruth Underwood is pretty good at talking about it.
Yeah.
It's like the only woman in the band. There was one other woman, but she couldn't take it. She only lasted a couple of weeks in the mid-70s. Ruth Underwood could take it among these guys, and she's like the best talker. And the most enthusiastic of them all. So it's interesting how women, a rare woman always is often the best in the field. But they didn't emphasize that in the 19th century. You know what I mean? It seems there's always a woman who's extra good. And she's in among the male world. Okay, so the next part. So rewinding, retracing, metanoia, in the figure of that is the S, which you're saying is the snake, and then you got the ladder. Whereas the total shape of each article or section that Aquinas writes, with its trinal divisions into objections, respondeo, and answers to objections, is whereas that is an S labyrinth, this figure is really traced and retraced by the mind many times in the course of a single article. Perhaps this fact helps to explain the power of Thomas Aquinas to communicate a great deal even before he is much understood.
Yeah, may I interrupt before you go further? Because I was thinking about the money symbol. You said the snakes and the ladders are also two different schools.
Yeah.
And you also have that in the money symbol. You have the S and the like the column, or it
That's
could
right.
also be a ladder.
Yeah.
And we have it there.
Space.
Yeah,
well, that's
visual space, banking, money.
Yeah, it can
there.
It swallows the polarities of tribal existence. Croker writes about this, how St. Augustine comes up with the third term, an abstract individual personality or even a soul that can swallow, go around the endless antinomies and polarities of classical experience back then and before visual space. So, you know, and you find tribal peoples, they get a little bit of writing, but they're very aware of the complementariness of things, the yin-yang of things. They haven't gotten into the lockdown phonetic alphabet and then printing press division and freezing of categories. So what was that? That's the S, the dollar sign. So with visual space, you can go around the polarities in normal experience of people's temperaments between the eye and the ear, between one preference and another. They can generalize to some people are eye people and other people are ear people. They couldn't resolve that in Greek in those years before Christ. So then the Romans could. First of all, Alexander, he could spread because with the phonetic alphabet, he could translate all the diverse local oral languages, which only meant what they meant in their scene, in their valley, and it couldn't be translated to other cultures. But when you come up with the 26 letters of the phonetic alphabet, it's a machine that can process the local eccentricity in speech and make a standardized translation. Then you got everybody on the same page, and that's how Alexander got his empire going, taking advantage of the phonetic alphabet. But he didn't have the papyrus and other tools to maintain it. Then the Romans maintain it with still the same phonetic alphabet. If the Romans couldn't retain it, then someone else is going to go through the phonetic alphabet and go through the same cycle, the same robot, make a horizontal empire if they've got the materials. The materials dictate the layout of the empire. So Ion communicates a lot before it's understood. So McLuhan says the labyrinth fact helps to explain the power of Thomas Aquinas to communicate a great deal even before he's much understood. It certainly suggests why he can provide rich aesthetic satisfactions by the very dance of his mind, a dance in which we participate as we follow him. His articles can be regarded as vivisections of the mind in act. Now, there's the detachment we're talking about. Watch yourself. His articles can be regarded as vivisections of the mind in act. The skill and wit with which Aquinas selects his objections constitute a cubist landscape. So he's taking these, you know, ancient religious guys who would not seem to have anything to do with art, and you got the radical pagan artists of the 20th century. They're both doing the same thing, collaging, even though they have whole different ideologies. But if you look at the electric age as retrieving acoustic, tactile sensibility, which was the sensibility in the medieval era before, or even the Dark Ages era, before the printing press, then that's why the artist would be the same as a religious guy. They both are using the Cubist landscape. An ideal landscape of great intellectual extent seen from an airplane. So his objections, his articles, constitute a Cubist landscape, an ideal landscape of great intellectual extent seen from an airplane. Now, you can see this is what Ion does, too. Much, you know, we complain about Ion going into too many metaphors. That's just, he's juxtaposing, collaging different aspects. Right? Like Aquinas did. Or Picasso.
Yes, and that's the tarot also. They have all these.
Yeah, the tarot. Archetypes. Yeah. The ideas or objects in this landscape are, by their very contiguity or juxtaposition, set in a state of dramatic tension. And this dramatic tension is provided with a dramatic peripeteia or flip in the respondeo and with a resolution in the answers to the objections. Now, I'd have to look at an actual Thomistic article and see these parts, so I don't visualize totally accurately what he's saying here. But there's flips and resolutions and counter statements, and this dramatic.
It's really like reading the tarot. You put all these cards, you put them
right
together, and then you see them, and you get like some type of response from these archetypes.
Right. So the tarot reader lays out a collage of cards on the table.
Yeah, and then he has these responses that he thinks he's getting from these archetypes.
Right. So, have you ever looked at a Thomas Aquinas article?
Yes, but not with this understanding.
Right. But it was part of your education?
Yes, you hear about him. He's very important.
In the Catholic world and French education. So, so he's saying there's a dramatic tension between the peripeteia or flip point in the respondeo and then the resolution in the answers in the objections. But it starts off with objections, then the respondeo, and then there's some kind of better objections or solutions that counter the original objections. Something like that's going
and
on.
And actually, Hegel, his dialectic, is just remake of this. The
is that
thesis,
right?
The antithesis and the
synthesis.
Yeah,
yeah, the Hegelian dialectics. Thesis, antithesis,
yeah,
and synthesis.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's probably similar.
That's why it's so important, because he was seeing that already.
Right. So you have this layout, and McLuhan says this whole thing about Aquinas, and much more was grasped by the young James Joyce, who seems to have been the first to make explicit the relation in Aquinas between the stages of apprehension and the creative process. It's almost like everybody was too busy in the content idea of marveling at genius and didn't know that genius came from an awareness of the ordinary drama of perception. That's what Joyce is going to realize, that he's the first to make explicit. You say something, Carol? Yeah, he was the first to make explicit the relation in Aquinas between the stage of apprehension and the creative process. In Aristotle, the same view is also implicit, as Joyce was aware. Now, probably LaRouche doesn't agree. LaRouche does talk about replaying processes and the students redoing all the famous experiments. So there's a retracing there. But LaRouche objects to the Aristotelian conclusion, which is a non-soul conclusion. It's sort of more materialist than Plato. So it'd be interesting to have LaRouche respond to this article and find out the nitpicking differences. So in Aristotle, the same view is also implicit, as Joyce was aware. In the Poetics, something Aristotle wrote, Aristotle mentions imitation is connate to man, being the process by which men learn. So there's the example of you never can catch awareness of the present because you're miming the present, and you're usually a phase back when you're miming existence, which is what Ion says it's already happened, or that you're going backwards. What's a neutrino do? It goes back. It happens. The effects precede the causes. the neutrino, is it the already happened? Forget what that was.
Already happened.
Third, already happened. Yeah, maybe that's it, just the already happened. And then you have
Yes, when Ion is saying about the new blood, he says nobody's going to even see it. And he says the Indians could not see the ships because they never saw before. So they could not even see it. So if you don't know about this, you don't even perceive it. That's why maybe we're in the past, because we cannot see what we don't. Yeah,
right.
We can't
you
even
have
perceive
to be shown.
It.
You have to be shown, which means you're looking to the outer world for affirmation, validation of your existence. So it's actually a fallen state to look and try to catch something outside of yourself. You're always going to be a step back. So somehow you, the ascended person is viewing the present and is caught up to the present by being indifferent to what the present is somehow. When you're reaching to grasp the present, you'll be a step behind. So the senses are the first medium. The medium is the message. The medium is conditioning your ideas about what you think you're experiencing. The sensory life is the first medium. And then the technologies are extensions of those senses. That's all in the Aristotelian view. This is not LaRouche's view. LaRouche goes to higher and higher abstraction and says that works. In the Poetics, Aristotle mentions imitation as connate to man, being the process by which men learn. But this fact is not linked with the power of abstraction, which in the De Anima, Aristotle attributes to the nous poeticus, or the agent intellect. So the fact of...
I suppose this is why I cultivates all these things in like TV programs. He's already showing you things so that then when you see it for real, like portaling, there is no time and all these things, you can sort of get it and see it.
Right. And the drama of cognition today involves people absorbing different media inputs. So what you just said, what was it you just said?
They cultivate things so that we can see them when they become.
Right. So everything's already happened. Effects precede causes. The medium is the message, Ion would say. So the agent intellect is this phrase, NOUS POIETIKOS, poeticus, the nous poeticus, or the agent intellect. That was what I was trying to find in that video. I was trying to say what caused the person to go to make the fall, to make chromosome 14. But I said, well, where's the agent intellect within that? Then you get into arguments about intention, what is doing the intending. So in the Poetics, he seems to mention imitation, and he's get that down, but that imitating fact that you're always a step behind, but this fact is not linked with the power of abstraction, which in the De Anima, Aristotle attributes to the nous poeticus, or the agent intellect. So Joyce makes the connection of sensory imitation to the cognitive, creative act of perception, which we're calling the power of abstraction here. Okay, so that there is, however, a degree of poetic imitation in abstraction itself is plain from the fact that even in sensation, now he quotes St. Thomas Aquinas in De Anima with one of their convoluted statements, he goes, is plain from the fact that even in sensation, things exist in the soul without their proper matter, but with the singularity and individuating conditions which are the result of matter. See, they're saying there's a medium there that cause and effect. But I'm not going to spend time trying to figure out what that actually is. That there is, however, a degree of poetic imitation in abstraction itself is plain from the fact that even in sensation, things exist in the soul without their proper matter, but with the singularity and individuating conditions which are the result of matter. So there is the chicken and egg. That this is so is the effect of the nous poetico. So the agent intellect causes this, which has the power individuating anew in a bodily organ that which it has abstracted from existence. So now it brings in the agency of the being, of the human, causing something. It abstracted it from existence, and that becomes part of a new bodily organ or new part of the sensory life. So that this is so is the effect of the nous poeticos, which has the power of individuating anew in a bodily organ that which it has already abstracted from existence. Doesn't say always, but seems to be that's what it means, that which it has abstracted from existence. Then has another quote, for in things made by art, the action of an instrument or technology is terminated in the form intended by the artisan. I'm sure that means the medium is the message. What do you think, Bert? Can you explain that? You're
yes.
looking at it.
Yes, for things made by art, an actual instrument is terminated form intended. Yes, the medium is the message. That's
it seems
what I
to be saying something like
as.
That. You're using
yes.
a tool.
Instrument.
The tool shapes the world, and then the tool shapes you, or the tool imitates you. This back and forth, what I call chicken and egg, is what mm-hmm. seems to be being described here. Now, this could be called scholastic babble and arguing over the head of a pin. And this is what Descartes and the mathematicians, Newton, come in with their calculus to simplify this. They actually make it go mm-hmm. in one direction due to the printing press's univocal effect, which then makes an improvement in ballistics, shooting in one direction, and then rocketry. And then you get to the moon because you abstracted the natural going in all directions at once in no time into a directed thing. And the technology helped you do that. It shaped you into thinking that way so you could make the new products. For in things made by art, the action of an instrument is terminated, ended, in the form intended by the artisan. So that's sort of saying the mind of the artist is guiding things. I guess that illustrates the nous poeticos.
You explain also that the artist sees things so that he trains our perception and also prepares to the new environment.
Yes. Now that's where the things exist in the soul without their proper matter. The soul already has got everything happening. And these things, the new environment is not in matter yet. So I sort of adapt that.
The fact that I am interacted with so many people at the beginning, really, like, doing these readings.
Yeah.
And in all these readings, he put some ideas, some concepts, something that was relevant for everybody, not only for the person doing the
right
session.
It was relevant to the person. Either they could see that immediately or they couldn't. But it was they might see it first. Then when we play the recordings in public, people say, oh, I can see where that applies to me. They might get a little mm-hmm. slower. But the actual private session, interacting with Ion probably leads to speeded up insight of how the idea that can be applied to everybody applies to you. Ion makes it apply to you. You have something to say there, Bert?
Yes, I was agreeing because that's the big thing that helps everyone listening to the Ion clips.
Yeah. And then it says, again, quote, for every object produced by art is the effect of the action of an artificer. So the human is making it. The agent intellect being related to the phantasms, mm-hmm. to the illusions illuminated by it as an artificer. The agent intellect being related to the phantoms illuminated by it. So the agent makes things more visible. Illuminated, and that is like an artificer, the maker, is to the things made by his art. So the agent intellect,
yes,
the mind.
I was thinking about Plato, that he said Ion is a rhapsode.
Yeah.
And Ion was saying the new art is the new song. And he was always saying, this is the new song.
Right,
so
right.
So he was saying, this is the new art form that is shaping your perception and your environment.
Right, so Ion is
so shaping. The art form is the whole environment, all the environments.
Right, so Ion is the nuos poeticos, the agent intellect. So those terms are hopelessly inadequate.
Really shaping everything at the elements level, the molecules, the frequencies, blah, blah, blah. And it's really...
So for every object produced by Ion...
At all levels, he's shaping, reshaping. Yes, the new creation is the ionic environment or an environment, like he says.
Right, and the agent intellect, Ion, being related to the phantoms illuminated by it. So Ion points out things that take on a reality, but in the end they're phantoms compared to other overlaid realities. So that relationship of the agent intellect to the things illuminated by it is as an artificer or maker is to the things made by his art. So something makes something. And then, for some reason, these guys need to write it out to show how they echo on each other.
Yes,
so then,
and you know, Rhapsodes also sang. Well, they have also choirs, and it was not
they
only
they sang what they sang what
they were the Rhapsodes will sing. They will have like a lyre, or it's not only spoken words, but it was
right
singing.
Yeah, the music
and. Yeah, the Rhapsode Ion always said, this is the new song, this is the new song, this is the new frequency, this is the new song. So he was really
right.
Showing how this is the new art form.
Yeah, Ion was, like any artist, working with the past and adding a new wrinkle to it, which then becomes a new environment, and then that's added to. So McLuhan says, and in the same place, the creative efficacy of the nuos poeticus is as illuminative. So in the same place, so he's saying it's also in the Bible, in Psalms 4:7. He says, and in the same place, the creative efficacy of the nuos poeticus as illuminative, lightning, is referred to the text in the Psalms 4:7, and the quote is, the light of thy countenance is signed upon us, O Lord. The light of thy countenance is signed upon us, O Lord. So we are shaped by the Lord, or Ion, the non-physical, when you're a little man. It's all little man aphorisms. The light of thy countenance is signed upon us. Now, this would continue. You'll have this effect, but you're watching yourself go through it. And maybe you could change the pace of it. So all that said at the beginning of this essay, then he starts getting into Joyce. And he says, for Joyce and Eliot, T.S. Eliot, all art is a shadow of the incarnation. Now, incarnation is capitalized. And every artist is dedicated to revealing or epiphanizing the signatures of things, so that what the nuos poeticos is to perception and abstraction, the artist is to existence at large. So the agency of the consciousness or the brain is to perception and abstraction, the way the artist is to existence. So the artist is shaping the social mortar and sees the hidden effects of it, just like, and therefore can control it or make an art form that stuns people with its accuracy. Same thing as what your own maker in your mind, your tactile organ, does with perception and abstraction, sense and nonsense or concept. But all art is a shadow of the incarnation. Now, if you think of Ion as the incarnation or the second coming, that's why it includes all the art forms and TV shows that ever happened. See, this is what's interesting, where McLuhan makes a statement, and we can adapt it to Ionic interpretation. And that gives credit to McLuhan. He's saying the right things. For Joyce and Eliot, now I don't know if this is true, but he gives quotes that seem to support it. that Joyce and Eliot felt this way. All art is a shadow of the incarnation, the shadow of Jesus. And every artist is dedicated to revealing or epiphanizing the signatures of things, so that what the nous poeticos is to perception and abstraction, the artist is to existence at large. Then the first novel that Joyce wrote, called Stephen Hero, which later, when he kind of threw that away, he got frustrated with it, he then redid it as the portrait of the artist as a young man. But there's a lot of philosophy and statement of technique, explaining technique in Stephen Hero. So people use it a lot, whatever part of the manuscript they retrieved. Apparently his sister pulled it out of the fire that Joyce threw it in. So Joyce has probably Stephen Dedalus. Remember, Dedalus made the Labyrinth. And that's what the character is called, an Irish kid. The artist who could disentangle the subtle soul of the image from its mesh of defining circumstances most exactly and re-embody it. Okay. The artist who could disentangle the subtle soul of the image from its mesh of defining circumstances, that's like the medium, defining circumstances, who could do that most exactly and re-embody it in artistic circumstances, chosen as the most exact for its new office, the one that could do that, he was the supreme artist. So it's almost, you could look at any technology that the humans make. We adapt matter to an artistic situation, end up making a plow. So the artist who could disentangle the subtle soul of the image from its mesh of defining circumstances in the blur of a perception, extract something most exactly, and then re-embody it in artistic circumstances chosen as the most exact for its new office, and artistic circumstances can make new technology, he was a supreme artist. So then McLuhan says, ordinary experience is a riot of imprecision, of impressions enmeshed in preconceptions, cliches, profanities, and impercipience. So all this sort of rough perception, confused buzzing, that's ordinary experience. It's a riot of imprecision, of impressions enmeshed in preconceptions, cliches, profanities, and impercipience. But for the true artist, every experience is capable of an epiphany, to kind of put it into order, I would say. By an epiphany. So now another quote from Stephen Hero. The first quote was page 78. This is page 211. By an epiphany, Stephen meant a sudden spiritual manifestation, whether in the vulgarity of speech or gesture, or in a memorable phase of the mind itself. So, you know, finding significance in vulgarity, it wasn't too cool in the Victorian era. Imagine my glimpses of that clock as the gropings of a spiritual eye, there's time, which seeks to adjust its vision to an exact focus. The moment the focus is reached, the object is epiphanized. It is just in this epiphany that I find the third, the supreme quality of beauty. So you're going to have beauty as opposed to the whatness of the object. So I don't think I'll just go into detail. You guys have to rehear this or look online. Let's see if Bert posted it. Did you post it, Bert? Not yet, eh? Look at Robert. He says, what?
Yeah, I did. Did you? Down a little bit because people have been posting.
Oh, okay. Way down there. Here's the article. Okay, Peter Berkman. So look at Robert. He says, you think Thomas was on to something, Bob? Yeah, you think he was on to something? Well, McLuhan certainly thought Thomas was on to it, and it made Joyce great. That's the theme here, Robert. Leave me out of it. I'm just the vehicle. I don't even agree with anything I'm talking about. I don't have a mind to agree with you or me. He also writes before that, man boobs music. So with a little rose there. Okay, so here we are. Ordinary experience is a riot of imprecision, just like the blank canvas. But it's not so blank if you bring in the soul, which already knows everything before you're going to experience it. So what is an epiphany? When you put it in order, when you get a pattern out of it, it's a sudden spiritual manifestation, whether in the vulgarity of speech or gesture, or in a memorable phase of the mind itself. Imagine my glimpses of that clock as the gropings of a spiritual eye which seeks to adjust its vision to an exact focus. That's the quest. you're trying to adapt your awareness to an exact new format. The moment the focus is reached, the object is epiphanized. So he's partly talking about seeing the act of seeing an object, and also that's a metaphor for seeing beauty. It is just in this epiphany that I find the third, the supreme quality of beauty. So then McLuhan says, Joyce identified the three notes of beauty of St. Thomas with the three operations of the intellect. So he identified the three notes of beauty of St. Thomas, said that parallels the three operations of the intellect.
But the Chile has a painting of the three graces.
The what? The Chile?
It's another archetype from antiquity, the three graces.
Oh, the graces, yes, G-R-A-C-E-S, yeah, right. And, yes, the three again, the three operations of the intellect. This could be other aspects of the three faces, three notes of beauty. So Joyce is going to relate it to what back in his day might be called psychology. The literate person thinks the intellect is like this psychological process. But Joyce is going to expand it beyond traditional psychology. So he identified the three notes of beauty as the three operations of the intellect, which are part of the stages of apprehension or the drama of cognition or the stages of ordinary experience. What is the cliche?
That's why I'm so amazed with the design of the bottle, because it's like all this information is contained in this three-phase character.
Right, right. That's pretty incredible. You discovered the three faces. I mean, maybe scholars of religion and mythology know about that, but I never knew about the three faces.
It's also an archetype from antiquity. There were also gods with three faces, and like the Hathors.
Yeah, like I've seen the image, but didn't know how it was explained. But why would I bother? I was waiting for fucking Ion to tell me what it meant. That's why I faked being human. Oh, yeah, I understand. Yeah, I know McLuhan. Yes, I can tell you some McLuhan stuff. You know, I just bide my time. So I try not to keep bringing it back to myself.
Well, it's Hermes Trismegistos.
Yes, Hermes Bob. Bob Meziskos. So the three operations of the intellect lead to the epiphany. So we've had the basic statement of the spiritual manifestation, which is vulgarity of speech or gesture. So he quotes from Stephen Hero, where the character says, "Now for the third quality. For a long time, I couldn't make out what Aquinas meant." The character is saying this. "He uses a figurative word, a very unusual thing for him, but I have solved it. Claritas is quiditas." So the third note is claritas. There's another essay. He writes out three names, but I don't think they're in this one.
Claritas means clarity.
Yes. No, I understand that. But there's two other names for other parts of the three notes of beauty, but they don't seem to be – he doesn't have that in this essay. He just got the third one. Claritas is quiditas. Quiddity is like the essence of something, it seems, or the whatness. So clarity is whatness. Remember he said it's the focus is reached the moment the object is epiphanized. The moment the focus is reached, the object is epiphanized. That focus is like a kind of clarity or claritas. After the analysis, which discovers the second quality, the mind makes the only logically possible synthesis and discovers the third quality. This is the moment which I call epiphany. First, we recognize that the object is one integral thing. Then we recognize that it is an organized composite structure, a thing, in fact.
Yeah, yes. The Thomas Aquinas said the other elements of beauty are integritas and consonantia.
Yes. All right.
Integrity and consonance.
Right. So the first one. First, we recognize the object is one thing. You kind of notice it's an objectness. Then we recognize it is an organized composite structure. That would be your, what's the second word? Consonantia.
Consonantia.
Yeah. So the first is it's a thing that's integratus. Then consonantio is kind of organized. It's a thing, in fact. Not just one integral thing. It's a thing, I guess a particular thing. Finally, when the relation of the parts is exquisite, when the parts are adjusted to the special point, we recognize that it is that thing which it is. So it gets more and more particular. So at first phase, you notice there's a thing. Then you kind of notice some aspects of it, and then you notice what it really is. Its soul, its whatness, leaps to us from the vestment of its appearance. The soul of the commonest object, the structure of which is so adjusted, seems to us radiant. The soul of the commonest object, the structure of which is so adjusted, once you see the third degree of beauty, seems to us radiant. The object achieves its epiphany. In a way, the Android meme achieved its epiphany after the Global Theater. It's an object. And Bodhya writes about the object that we're up against. The Android meme is kind of like an object. So what do you think of that, Bert? This is what Joyce is working out his ideology, you know, as many young artists do. They have to work out an intellectual framework before they can start taking the details of existence and making art out of it. This is an important book, almost thrown away, where his theory is spelled out. You getting that, Bert?
Yes. Yes.
Yes, and
yes.
Also the way in which Aquinas was trying to explain God is like the three aspects of God, the Holy
yep,
Spirit,
yep.
The Son. It's again these three characters.
Yeah,
he was trying to explain God with the claritas, the integritas, and the consonants.
Okay, but look at this. The object achieves its epiphany. What the theologians of the visual space, Gutenberg Galaxy commentators, didn't realize that the thing achieved its objectness because of visual space. That they weren't aware of.
Mm.
Because in the 20th century, the electric age disintegrates the object, dematerializes it. We end up into a resonant blur. Are you getting this, Nick? I wonder if anybody's being blocked, because my thing is not renewing itself. And I can't unmute people. It's ridiculously dying every 5 minutes or less. So nobody's unmuted, nobody's muted.
This is showing McLuhan's scholarship. This is
yes.
Showing McLuhan's scholarship to actually break down Thomas Aquinas, which is very abstract, but then also to show Joyce's thought patterns of how he was developing his philosophy, which led into his other two books.
Yep. Yeah, and McLuhan figured it out. This is McLuhan, the philosopher, thinking things out, and he's going to gear it to his own particular eccentric theological position. You know what I mean? He's going to make it McLuhan.
Yeah.
But this other essay, Prelude to Prufrock, has a lot of some of this talk and traces it back to Mallarmé and another guy, Julius Lamontagne, forget his name, LaFontaine maybe. Montaigne, these various guys in the symbolist movement, they're the guys that Joyce studied. So McLuhan's going to make the point in this essay that you have to go back and study those guys before Joyce to understand what Joyce is, and then you're able to write what McLuhan's writing. But yes, he's showing what he studied, and then he's going to make it relate to what the abstract avant-garde artists and thinkers and poets did was already discovered by St. Augustine. And St. Thomas Aquinas. Now, that's a pretty big connection to bring it back to the enemy, the Catholic Church. And, you know, people associate in the street, these poets were not pro the Vatican, right? They're trying to protect the people.
Yeah.
At least that would be the cultural Marxist view, say. So, so when I first read this 50 years ago, having had no real education, and I knew nothing about Jesuit or Catholic theology, I didn't know what the fuck this was. What am I reading? You know, what is this stuff? Am I actually going to go fucking get a copy of Stephen Hero and have to read the whole book? Fuck that. I'm too lazy. I'm going to go talk to Dave Worster and talk to non-physical. Fuck this shit. So I would skirt between heavy academic reading, which would have ruined my eyes and made me fat and unathletic and a lousy fuck. So I would compromise by going to a psychic guide who'd give me stuff that was different and maybe saying the same thing but in different ways that it could be said to me. I didn't have to read it, just talk it.
Yes, but it is really interesting because in Christianity, they always try to explain God as a trinity.
Yeah.
And then we see what that all these character,
what was behind that?
The king with the three faces means.
In other words,
your bottle.
Right, but McLuhan is bringing in the role of the artist in theology, which, because of social taboos, the way the artist was, no one would think the artist was relevant to theology. And so Joyce is working out, like you say, the three parts of God and relating it to aesthetics, to the perceiving of new art, which is what humans actually make. So it's very profound, the whole thing, and McLuhan's great positioning in the middle of it all and making the connections from the past to the present to the future, at the same time knowing it's all happening at the same time and all that. It's just something to McLuhan's mind is an art form to appreciate in itself. Right?
Yeah, this illustrates what you said the beginning of last week about McLuhan improvising of everything that happened before, how he pulled things all together.
Yeah.
That's how I see it in the Trivium as well. You see he was transformed when he did his research for his PhD.
Yeah.
That Trivium is amazing.
Yeah, and he is being influenced by his experience of his mother and her artistic performance. Mm. He says it in Playboy, when he realized that all art is personal experience, that was a big epiphany for him. So it maybe liberated him from trying to figure out what art was in terms of general rules. It was always a distortion of experience by the individual nous poeticos, the agent intellect of the person. So that would encourage you to make your own art, knowing that your personal experience is the material. The cliché, you turn it into archetype. This is all summarized by the cliché ordinary drama of perception. It got archetypalized by Joyce, made into immense significance, the stages of apprehension. Then he links it to all the concepts in art. So this is as interesting as Einstein or physics. You know what I mean? This kind of knowledge.
Yeah.
I found it more interesting than matter description.
And it's actually in art, like from Isis and Osiris and Horus to the Holy Family, like Mary and the Father and Jesus, and then the God and the Holy Spirit and Jesus. So there's always this Trinity and the fact that ions were not one. Were many.
Right. Okay, so they all say religion seems to emphasize family, is what I saw some guys saying lately.
Yeah, also the
value
the
of
Masons,
family.
The Masons have the 33. The double
and what's
three.
That? 33?
Well,
three.
There are.
Oh, yeah,
there
double
are
three.
Some,
I see your point.
For
yeah,
me, all
three.
These. Images of religion, now I see them as they come from alchemy and from hermeticism.
And the art thing. Once you get a handle on what I'm reading here, you'll be able to incorporate the Aquinas part or the Joycean categories into what you're talking about. The three faces of you know, that image of the king can be the three notes of beauty. Or
yes,
now, here's
In art, there is the heavenly trinity, that is the God, the Holy Spirit, and Jesus, and the Holy Family, that's like the earth trinity. But actually, these two, earth from the earth trinity, the Holy Family.
Yeah. Okay, you'll see that in my early top-down identity and bottom-up identity, the family becomes archetypalized by Jesus. So...
But
we're now in a crisis.
Also always in alchemy, the alchemical marriage. You have the female, the male, and then in the middle, the son. And in like in the king driving the chariot, you have on one shoulder is female, the other shoulder is male. And the result is like Ion says, the divine child.
So this metaphor.
The sacred marriage.
But this is, I'm going to say that pre-literate Aboriginal societies, they didn't know who the father was. So it was a communist society. They are before writing starts to specify linear blood descendants or, you know, progeny, that's the beginning of the family dynamic. And our society has gone beyond family with the genetics and all that stuff. They have a crisis of the family archetype. So the family itself, that's why I have the family in my Dobbs formula chart that I talked about in your video. So the archetype of the family is the archetype of little man. Yeah, McLuhan talked about the family being the core of religion in one of the things I read by him this week, something like that. So you'll
but
see.
But in Alchemy, it's actually something else that Dionysus also always talking about this.
Right, the family,
marriage,
the biological family is a big deal, and so Ion comes on as a spiritual voice and says, "Fuck the family, let the kid die if it wants to." That's pretty sacrilegious there, and the womb is closing. All these things, anti-family or not making a big deal out of the family, is the Ionic truth, and so that would include, Ion includes pre-writing societies, caveman societies, who probably were indifferent to what was born. Maybe threw them away if they were not useful, just killed them. See, so we're moving towards that caveman brutality from the literate person's point of view.
Yeah.
You know, you have these mothers killing their kids. I mean, there's probably nothing more shocking in the American news scenario than those kind of stories, right?
Yes.
And do I have an agreement there? Do I have a high five on that point?
Yes, double.
Yeah, double high five, two threes. So the three, so the when there's family, it's the root of crisis or conflict because every child is looking at the mother and father and wants a reflection of approval on them. And then they have to conflict with the other child that's a trinity, the father and the wife, mother, for reflecting on that child. So the basic seeking of approval and validation of your personality, of your being, is the first dilemma of fallen man. First conflict.
Yeah.
So heavy, the three Bob. Notes of beauty. What was the last words?
That was heavy. That conflict. I mean, it's
the initial emotional division, and then all people are affected by the relationships in their family, and that sets their emotional temperament. You know, one sister is very different from the other sister, and they find out what the older sister's like. Says, "Well, I don't want to be like that," so they go to the opposite. So, in the family is the whole drama of social interaction, of social mortar. So, the three notes of beauty can be the relationship between the father, the mother, and the kid. And so, the kid projects. Is the mother Claritas or Consonantia or the last one, Epiphany? I don't know what the last one was called. Claritas. The shifting of emotional favoritism among the family members is what beauty is. Beauty is a concretization, a solidification of emotional direction. Right? You get that?
Yeah. Yes.
So we turn the page. We read all that. The three parts. First, we recognize that the object is one integral thing. Maybe it's like the kid realizes there's a family. Then we recognize that it is an organized.